Welcome, everyone, to the Vital Conversation. We're so glad you're here, and we're even more excited that you're interested in talking about vitalism. So this conversation is brought to you by the Naturopathic Medicine Institute. The Institute envisions a world where enjoying optimal health allows people to reach their highest potential for inspired creativity. It asserts that the highest ideal in healthcare must act in concert with the healing power of nature. So this little intro here is from Dr. Jim Sensenig, and it speaks to why we're doing what we're doing.
We're doing it because I and many people in the profession are concerned that there is a time-honored way of making sense out of medicine and healing and the role of the physician, and in a way that can result in better outcomes than we see in our culture. And we in the Vitalist School, the people who have the great privilege of, you know, being the progeny, I suppose, of those many thinkers, physicians, male and female, indigenous healers and others who have examined this, we have this beautiful way, this almost seemingly secret way of understanding how this phenomenon works to the benefit of all and to the benefit of those who are in service to others. And we are not capturing that or articulating that as well as we could in our current practices. We all have more to learn. We all have something to build on. And we want to bring that back in a way that it not only doesn't get lost, but that it informs us so that we can be the kind of physicians that we want to be in service to those who need our help. I think that's where we're going. And then on the practical level, we want to talk about it. We want to examine it. We want to unpack it. We want to be able to express these underlying principles so that they're not only understood, but they're understood to be inviolate. And on the most practical level, we need to teach each other how they can be applied to the benefit of the human race and the rest of the world, for that matter.
Welcome, everybody, this morning to, or this afternoon, wherever you may be in the world, to the Naturopathic Medicine Institute and the Vital Conversation. Today, we have Dr. Jim Sensenig and Dr. Rick Kirshner, and we're going to be discussing the concept of vitalism. And with that, I'm going to turn over this amazing conversation to these two fantastic doctors.
Hello, everyone. Dr. Sensenig here. It's a beautiful day where I am, and I hope it's a beautiful day where you are. And so as not to waste any further time, I think we'll get started. But I have to tell you that I've got something that is calling me away. So I'm going to introduce our guest host for today, who is Dr. Rick Kirshner. Dr. Kirshner, are you there?
I'm here, Jim. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be
okay.
Here. And see ya. Thank you. So we are going to talk about vitalism today, and as the guest host, I'm super excited to introduce my guest, Dr. Jim Sensenig. Jim, are you there?
I'm here. Thank you.
Wow, I'm glad that worked out. Hey,
good.
So I'm just going to say this right up front, which is that whenever you talk, I like to listen. So I'd like you to just take the ball and run with it. Talk to us about vitalism, this core idea that the Naturopathic Medicine Institute has championed as the center of our profession. What do you have to say about it?
Well, I have this to say. I think it's, in some ways, it seems to me like it's really simple, and it's like I don't quite understand the confusion. If you look at Tabor's medical dictionary, vitalism is defined as the opinion that a force neither chemical nor mechanical is responsible for the phenomenon of life. I think this is really, I think rather than just talking, I really want to emphasize what I'm going through here this morning. So Tabor's Medical Dictionary, let's start right there. The Medical Dictionary, which is where a lot of people like to start their discussions about definition, the opinion that a force neither chemical nor mechanical is responsible for the phenomenon of life. It's actually that simple. We're talking about vitalism, not with all its myriad interpretations and complications and so on. We're simply talking about vitalism in contrast to the other dichotomy, or in this dichotomy, the other end of the pole, which would be mechanism or materialism. And, you know, in thinking about how to address this, I'm reminded of Harris Coulter's divided legacy, the schism of thought in medicine. It should be, it used to be, as you know, when we were in school, it was required reading. I'm afraid it's not required reading anymore. But I want to just go through a couple of quotes from his introduction to this three-volume series on the divided legacy. Listen to the name. The divided legacy, the schism of history of the schism of thought in medicine. So this is not something that is unique to our situation right now or to medical thought in general. This is a divided legacy which can be traced back as far as we can trace back medical history. There are scholars in this profession who will tell you that the different poles of this dichotomy, which I'm going to get to here in a second, date back as far as Sumerian medicine, the first recorded medicine in the West, if not on the globe. And there are different ways of understanding it. But I think Coulter says it best. He says that after talking about medical thought and therapeutics, he talks about medical thought grows out of and is governed by therapeutic experience. Therapeutic theories in all their variety are attempts to make sense out of the healer's experience with the patient. Then he goes on to talk about what does that mean exactly? We're trying to make sense out of the healer's experience with the patient. Well, later on, he talks about the fact that we have all kinds of ways of examining patients, which range from the ancient and the primitive to more sophisticated and more technological ways to look at the physicality or the biochemistry or whatever of the patient. We can do x-rays and CAT scans and PET scans. We can do biopsies and all kinds of blood tests and so on, where our predecessors did not have the technology to do that. But all of them were doing the same thing, gathering information about the patient. Coulter makes this point. None of this information is self-interpreting. That's an important point. None of the information that we're gathering about the patient, lab tests, PET scans, none of these are self-interpreting. Neither the symptoms nor the patient's own account of his aches or pains or miseries, nor the results of the most sophisticated measuring techniques provide the physician with anything more than raw data. He must still determine their meaning. And then he goes on to say that the great medical thinkers have all sought a role or roles permitting the correct interpretation of the primary data of experience. I'll say that again. The great medical thinkers have all sought a role or roles permitting correct interpretation of this primary data of experience. History shows that the search for interpretive rules can be conducted along two alternative lines. So this is trying to make sense out of the raw data by interpreting it in a way that makes sense from a therapeutic point of view. And he's telling us that this goes along two alternative lines. Those two lines, he says, he talks about an author that he's quoting, which is a gentleman named Arturo Castiglione, who says that he characterizes the two poles of the dichotomy as the technomorphal and the cosmical, vitalistic, and synthetical. Now, this is culture tracing medical thought from ancient times, telling us that there's two different ways of interpreting the data. One is, again, technomorphological, in Castiglione's words, technomorphological and chiefly analytical, and the other is cosmical, vitalistic, and synthetical. The first, which doubtless is the simplest and most ancient, places foremost the local symptoms of the disease and considers the affection of each, organ separately. This leads to localistic treatment based on the assumption of a cause and to mechanistic thinking generally. A second tendency attributes, get this, the second tendency attributes the origins of life and its functions to a superior vital energy, the physicists of Hippocrates being the most prominent example. This conception considers man to be an indestructible part of the cosmos, bound to it and subject to its laws. It may therefore be called a universal cosmical Unitarian conception. Disease, according to it, is a general fact which strikes the whole organism and has its origins in a perturbation of natural harmony. So there's your two poles. One of them is chiefly mechanistic. It leads to localized treatment because it sees the affection and the symptoms, the disturbance in the organs and the system separately and seeks to treat them. The other is a more, according to him, a more cosmological, synthetical, universal, Unitarian conception where the interpretation is that the disease is a general fact which strikes the whole organism and has its origins in a perturbation of natural harmony. Now, that's exactly what the forerunners of what we now call naturopathy spoke about in some great detail. If we go to Kent's lectures, Hahnemann. Hahnemann tells us in the ninth paragraph of the Organon, and by the way, a little aside here, Hahnemann did not write the textbook of homeopathy. He did not write the therapeutic manual of homeopathic remedies. He wrote the Organon of Medicine. He wrote a general thesis on what health and disease are and how the physician ought to intervene to return or to restore the sick to health. He was writing about medicine, not about a modality. In any case, in his ninth paragraph in the Organon, he says this: in the healthy condition of man, the spiritual vital force, the dynamis that animates the material body, rules with unbounded sway and retains all the parts of the organism in admirable, harmonious, vital operation as regards both sensations and functions, so that our indwelling, reason-gifted mind can freely employ this living, healthy instrument for the higher purposes of our existence. Hahnemann goes on through the rest of the Organon, and Kent gets into great detail in translating that into day-to-day for us, goes into great detail to tell us how this vital substance or simple substance or dynamis or vital force or whatever it is moves through the body and how it resists disease and corrects the disturbance in the sense that it is ordered, intelligent, and beneficent and restores normal function in the living system when it's allowed to do so. Let me also remind everybody who's listening about what Lindlar had to say here. Lindlar said, and I'm going to ask your indulgence while I read this because I think probably every word here is important. This is from Lindlar's chapter 4, What is Life in Nature Cure? In our study of the cause and the character of disease, we must endeavor to begin at the beginning, and that is life itself. For the processes of health, disease, and cure are manifestations of that which we call life, vitality, or life's elements. While endeavoring to fathom the mystery of life, we soon realize that we are dealing with an ultimate which no human mind is capable of solving or explaining. We can understand and study life only in its manifestations, not in its origins or its real essence. And then here we go again. There are two prevalent but widely differing conceptions of the nature of life, the material and the vital. The former looks upon life or vital force with all of its physical, mental, and psychical phenomenon as manifestations of the electric, magnetic, and physicochemical activities in the physical material elements composing the human organism. Now, remember, this was written well over a century ago, so some of this language is going to sound a little antiquated, but you can take from it the same meaning as it was intended at that point. I'm going to read that sentence again. The former looks upon the vital force with all of its physical, mental, and psychical phenomenon as manifestations of electric, magnetic, and physicochemical activities of the physical material elements composing the human organism. From this viewpoint, life is sort of a spontaneous combustion, or as one scientist expresses it, a succession of fermentations or chemical changes. In other words, my editorial comment there is today we would say biochemical functions. In other words, life is sort of a biochemical mechanical phenomenon which can be explained on the physical material level. The vitalistic conception of life, on the other hand, regards vital force as the primary force of all forces, coming from the great central source of all life. This force, which permeates and heats and animates the entire created universe, is an expression of divine intelligence and will, the logos or the word of the great creative intelligence. It is the divine energy which sets in motion the worlds of the ether and the electric corpuscles that make up the matter. So here we have a concept that matter is informed by or animated by or controlled by or responsible to or maybe manifesting something greater than itself. And that something greater is intelligent and orderly. He goes on to say that this intelligent energy can have but one source, the will of the Creator. If this supreme intelligence would withdraw its creative energy, the electrical charges, and now he's talking about what was known about energy 100 years ago, and with it, the atoms and the elements and the entire material universe would disappear in the flash of a moment. From this, it appears that crude matter, instead of being the source of all life and its complicated mental and spiritual phenomenon, which on the face of it is absurd, is but an expression of the life force, itself a manifestation of the great creative intelligence, which some call God, nature, oversoul, Brahma, Prana, the great spirit, each according to his own best understanding. And this paragraph, I think, is very poetic and very apropos as well. It is this supreme intelligence acting in and through every atom, molecule, and cell in the body, which is the true healer, the vis medicatrix natura, which always endeavors to repair or to heal or to restore the perfect type. All that the physician can do is to remove the obstructions and establish the normal conditions within and around the patient so that the healer within can do his work to his best advantage. Now, that takes me back to one of the things that if you want a really elegant breakdown for the critical thinker who can think logically about what we're talking about here, you don't have to look any further than Lecture 8 in Kent's Lectures on Homeopathic Philosophy. That's the one that's on simple substance. And I'm not going to go through the whole chapter, obviously because there's no time for that. But one of the things that he talks about is the different qualities or the different characteristics of this thing that Hahnemann calls simple substance, and some people call life force or vital force or whatever. One of the things that he talks about is how this force is not found in time and space. It's adaptive and constructive, and you cannot get rid of it. You can't kill it or turn it off or somehow get rid of it, implying, and these are my words, not his, that it's there all the time and that it precedes everything physical in our universe. And it also is there when the matter is gone. In other words, it's prior to and it's later than or remains. He also points out that's an interesting thing, that it's subject to, the matter is subject to reduction. And he has a paragraph in here where he talks about how matter can be broken down and broken down and broken down and so on to its constituents point or to its constituent parts. And when the matter's all gone, what's left is this formative intelligence or this thing called simple substance. But it can't go the other way. Once it's broken down, you can't put it back together. We can't put it back together on the physical level. Now, I would ask, how is that different from what quantum physics has told us in the last couple of years? The advancement of scientific materialism through the 20th century ended the century with telling us that behind the physical, visible, material universe is something else. There's something there that's variously called the zero point field, the matrix, if you want to get religious about it, the mind of God, whatever it is, there's some intelligent, orderly, beneficent something. I don't know if we want to even use the word force. Maybe it's not a force, maybe it's a process. But the sciences of the 20th century have come full circle from the material, understanding the material universe, to where they now understand or now teach that the material is informed by something else. And that something else is what we mean when we talk about the vital force. Now, that may be an antiquated word or an antiquated concept in the way it was used, but that's all we're saying, that the physical is informed by or reflects the greater organization of the universe, which can be thought of or understood on that other level. Now, I just had a thought that slipped from my mind there that I wanted to talk about that. Oh, and one of the arguments you'll hear sometimes is that, well, you can't prove that there's a vital force. You can't capture it and put it in a jar with holes in the lid, right? And put or weigh it or quantify it. Well, duh, of course not. By definition, it's not quantifiable. You can't put it in a jar with holes in the lid. And maybe one way to think about that phenomenon is that it's something that defies physical parameters. Therefore, how could you identify it in a physical material world? You know, it reminds me a little bit of the concept of gravity. You know, gravity, I mean, I think there's an analogy here. You cannot put gravity on the scale. You can't measure gravity. You can't measure that phenomenon. You cannot put it in a jar with holes in the lid or whatever, because gravity doesn't exist. Gravity is a term that we have agreed to use to describe a phenomenon wherein masses attract. And if I remember my physics 101 correctly, masses attract in direct proportion to the square root of their radius. That's the phenomenon that keeps us on the surface of the Earth and the Earth in the sun's orbit and so on and so forth. But instead of saying to each other every time we want to talk about that phenomenon that masses attract in direct proportion to the square root of their radius, we talk about gravity, and everybody understands that we're talking about a phenomenon. Could that not be the case with vital force? Is this thing vital force? It's not a noun, or at least it doesn't meet our definition of a noun, I suppose. And that gets into the whole argument about how our language shapes what we think and how we think and what's possible. And I've heard it said that before there was wind, that is to say, before persons called scientists identified a gaseous substance that was moving around that cannot be seen, then there was no real understanding of what was making the trees move in a storm, for example. And there is another, if I extrapolate from that for a minute, because I'm ranting or rambling now, maybe both, if we extrapolate from that, there was a time when there was no air because it was not identified as such, and therefore it didn't exist. There was nothing there in the concept of man. In other words, men, humans, did not understand that there's a gaseous substance, which we now call air or wind. Well, maybe vital force is the same thing. If you don't understand it and you don't want to, quote, believe that there's something going on there, well, then obviously you can't see it. Back to the gravity analogy for just a second. Maybe vital force, maybe vitality, maybe vitalism is simply a shorthand for the phenomenon that is the source, quoting Lindlar here, is a phenomenon that is the source of all life. And that's what we mean, perhaps, when we talk about vitalism, because we're talking about it in contrast to materialism. And it seems to me that at the beginning of the 20th century, absurd on the face of it, that there are people who would argue that everything in the physical universe is simply the result of the physical universe, and there's nothing prior to that. Okay, having said that, and then I'm going to open up for some questions, I think. Once we believe or agree or recognize that there's an intelligent something that is organizing life, then that becomes the basis for our therapeutic intervention. Because if that's true, and that is true for us in our therapeutic model, then everything we do moves around or is governed by or is an expression of that very concept. In other words, if we start with the idea that there's a formative intelligence, as Kent would say, then it's always moving in the direction of balance and restoration of health. So as Coulter said, with disease striking as a perturbation of the whole, then any deviation from that force's ability to confer normal function and structure is going to express itself in some symptoms, and that's what we call disease. And then from that flows our idea of the unity of the disease. From that, we see that there's a certain order to the order. So order is orderly. And there we start to invoke the laws of cure, which tell us that symptoms are going to move or change in an orderly fashion. From that, we get our concepts of suppression. From that, we get our concept of dual effect. From that, we get the concept of the minimum dose, and so on and so forth. So everything that we think in terms of the therapeutic application, or that which explains our therapeutic rationale, is based on the understanding that there's something greater at work here than just the physical. So I'm going to take a breath and get a drink. And Dr. Kirshner, are you still there?
I'm still here, Jim, and I'm loving this. This is so, it's not only fascinating, but it's, saying it, I find it entertaining, because we're talking about something that is fundamental to delivering our kind of healthcare. It's not just some old idea. It is a foundational idea. And, you know, I've had people say, well, I've never even heard of vitalism. It wasn't in the syllabus. Nobody mentioned it when I was signing up for school. And my response to that is, that's because we already had, it was included in the word naturopathy. We didn't pull it out and highlight it. It was implicit. But because of changes in our educational process, it's apparently no longer implicit. And that's what we're trying to do, is put it back where it belongs.
Yeah, you know, this reminds me of, I don't even know why this is coming up for me, but I was introduced by one of our colleagues a couple of years ago to something called hormesis. And it starts with something called radiation hormesis. And as I understand this, actually, I'm going to read a definition of radiation hormesis. This is supposedly was, quote, discovered by a fellow named Edward Calabrese, who was at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. What this theory is about, or what hormesis is a word that he coined to describe this phenomenon. Hormesis, related to radiation, is the hypothesis that low doses of ionizing radiation within the region and just above natural background levels are beneficial, stimulating the activation of repair mechanisms that protect against disease that are not activated in the absence of ionizing radiation. Now, the next sentence, pay attention to this. The reserve repair mechanisms, notice that wording, the reserve repair mechanisms are hypothesized to be sufficiently effective when stimulated as to not only cancel the detrimental effects of ionizing radiation, but also inhibit disease not related to radiation exposure. Now, here, this definition has to invoke the concept of a reserve repair mechanism that is sufficiently effective when it's stimulated to cancel the detrimental effects of radiation and inhibit disease not related to radiation exposure. This counterintuitive hypothesis has captured the attention of scientists and the public in recent years. So the discovery here, and I guess I don't really have to emphasize this, the so-called discovery here is that low doses of ionizing radiation, as found in the background, wherever you happen to live, actually protects you against ionizing radiation by stimulating the reserve repair mechanism. What is that?
Yeah.
Right? Oh, that sounds like, you know, that line from Alice in Wonderland. Well, it's no use going back to yesterday because I was a different person then. So the reason I bring up the hormesis, here's that same principle at work again. I'm beyond that now. I'm at the therapeutic level. The low doses of something will stimulate that something to be protective against that something. Sound like homeopathy? Only he called it. Yeah. So, Dr. Rick, do you have any input here?
The thing that I would love for you to talk about is, you know, now we have the Naturopathic Medicine Institute, which is trying to return us back to where we come from. And I find it really interesting that you were able to identify with this word vitalism as a central idea for that naturopathic revival. And I thought it'd be really interesting for you to talk about why we are now calling ourselves vitalistic naturopathic physicians.
Well, that's a good question. I think to emphasize the foundational principles of naturopathic medicine. You know, here again, you're reminding me of the movie that you produced about our history. Mm-hmm. And if we go back to that for just a second, you know, I hope that, well, first of all, you don't know who you are unless you know what your history is. And just for those who are listening, at least I'm not familiar with the history of naturopathy or naturopathic medicine in other countries, except a bit in Canada. But if we go back to the beginning of medicine as a profession in the United States, or what became the United States after being settled by the Europeans, the first medical school in this country was in 1765. And that was primarily a transfer of the kind of thing that passed for medicine in the European schools that taught medicine. And that was decidedly allopathic. That was a mechanistic approach to the human body where the symptoms were seen as the problem and the doctor's job was to get rid of the symptoms, which is still the philosophy upon which conventional medicine is based. And it was decidedly allopathic. Now, from my 1850 Dictionary of Medical Terms, allopathic is defined as the system of therapeutics that's based on contraries, where one morbid condition is replaced with another, hence the term another disease. And that was the problem and still is the problem with therapeutic approaches that are allopathic. When you treat the symptom as the problem and turn it off, suppress it, we say, they say, treat it, you have side effects. And to the point where by the time you get to 1850 or so, I read in Cody's history in the textbook of natural medicine that about half the people who consulted a medical doctor died. So those are pretty high numbers. Anyway, that profession called the regulars by themselves with their symptomatic treatment, mostly with heavy metals instead of statins and lisinopril, they were treating with heavy metals. Most scholars of medicine know that chief among them was mercury or calomel and antimony and others. However, there was a popular rebellion against that kind of harsh and heroic treatment, which included, and I won't go all into medical history here because we don't have the time to do it. But throughout the 18th and the 19th century, we had the growth of botanical medicine, mostly spurred by Samuel Thompson and his New Guide to Health, and the development of a whole system of medicine based on botanical extracts that he learned from the American Indians and the indigenous people of this culture, which then got passed on 50, 60, 70 years later into medicine for those more eclectic doctors who wanted to get away from that heroic practice. The hygienic movement, which sprouted in the beginning of that century and went through all of the 1800s, teaching rational eating, no animal products, whole grains, fasting, and so on and so forth, which eventually developed into the hygienic movement or the hygiotherapeutic movement. And then there was the introduction of homeopathy into the United States about the middle of that century. And then parallel to that, there's the whole night water cure and the information that Lust and his followers brought to the United States. By the way, just a little aside, a little trivia here. The first four-year full-time residential medical school in what is now the United States was the New York Hygiotherapeutic Institute. That was in 1852. That was 25 years before Harvard or Johns Hopkins introduced a four-year program. So in terms of the quality or depth of medical education, the first four-year full-time residential school for medicine that graduated medical doctors who were trained in the hygiotherapeutic system was in 1852. So there's a place where naturopathy is first. You never hear about that in medical history. Anyway, I bring this up to answer your question in this way. All of those medical spin-offs, you might say, are all of those other ways of approaching health and disease through botanical medicine, through diet and nutrition and hydrotherapy, through homeopathy, and through Lust teachings from Father Knipe and so on. They all have in common one thing, and that is that they're all vitalistic. They all teach the same thing, that is this, that health is when things are working well, when everything is in balance, when you have the natural harmony that this unnamed, unseen, unknowable force conveys. As Hahnemann says, where it rules with unbounded sway. And they all teach that one is sick in proportion to how far off balance or out of sync he might be, and all of the methods there that we're talking about, which include, oh, I forgot physical medicine too, including osteopathy and chiropractic, all of them from the eclectic botanical medicine, the hygienic, dietary, hydrotherapy, homeopathy, and the physical schools of medicine I just mentioned, they're all based on one thing, and that is restoring balance in the individual by working with or supporting or stimulating this thing we call vitality or vital force. Now, different schools of medicine have different terms for that, but if you look at them collectively, they're all the same. So those schools of medicine that I just rattled off came together, the leaders of, as I understand it, the political and administrative organizational leaders of those movements came together at the end of the 19th century to develop what's turned into what we call naturopathy. In other words, to have a physician trained not in the allopathic intervention of symptom repression with heavy metals, or any other medication, but those who were trained in an understanding of this formative intelligence or this vital principle or whatever. And because what they have in common is they all are, again, stimulating, working with, appreciating, understanding, respecting the vital force or this thing, it was prudent to, and because they're all, synergistic, then we want to have a physician who's trained in diet and fasting and in the use of plant medicines, the use of physical medicine, the use of homeopathy, and so on and so forth. And that was the naturopathic doctor. Lutz himself had degrees in osteopathy and chiropractic, as well as in homeopathy and naturopathy. He was very well schooled across all disciplines. And again, the idea was that what was thought of as nature cure and homeopathy and these other schools of medicine came together in direct contrast to, or one might even say in direct opposition to, the practice of conventional or allopathic or symptom-based medicine. So that's our legacy. We grew from, and our schools were established by, people who understood this principle and who had been teaching for 100 years that the way to do what Hahnemann says in paragraph 1, the physician's high and only mission is to restore the sick to health, to cure, as it is termed. The only way to do that is to work with that principle that does that, not against it, but with it. And then again, at the risk of being redundant, everything that we do therapeutically flows from that understanding and is consistent with how we understand that that principle or that formative intelligence or that vitality, how it operates in the living system. And you know what's really, and I don't know where this came from, somebody just kind of put it in my head here. This is somewhat unbelievable to me that we have this conversation at the level of the human being when everybody on the planet understands this principle when it comes to the earth itself. I mean, we're living at a time when, I'm going to use terms that we all understand, right? The earth is out of balance. It's polluted. Its homunculus are not working properly. It doesn't have what it needs to function properly. The vitality of the earth is being challenged, right? We all know that it is not sustainable. We all know, everybody from the youngest child on this planet to the oldest person on this planet who's paying attention realizes that the disturbance is so profound that it's affecting the weather and the balance of the earth and so on and so forth. And everybody knows, intuitively or otherwise, that unless something is done to reverse what's happening, we're in trouble. Why? Because you can't continue to have the disturbance that is manifesting in this way go on without death to the system. So the question on most people's mind, or many people's mind on the planet Earth, is what can we do to change the environment on our planet? What can we do to turn things around? And what do we mean by turn things around? We mean to get out of the way, remove the obstacles to cure, and allow the intelligence which informs the earth and the universe that we live in, whatever that force, by whatever name, allow it to return the earth to balance. So it's, you know, instructive to me that we think about or talk about or obsess about that phenomenon at the planetary level every day, and yet we can't apply those same principles to our own bodies. It's okay to go around polluting our body all the time?
or to just be more therapeutic about it, do we know and don't we understand? And you can see this on the internet and everywhere else. People know that if they are less polluted and they take fewer drugs and they are exposed to fewer toxins, and if they give their body the nutrients that they need, that they will heal. Well, what is heal? What does heal mean? Well, here we go back to Kent, and we go back to Lenlar, and we go back to Hahnemann and the other writers. Heal means the restoration of order in the system. And what is it that restores that order? And our predecessors would argue that we can think of that as the vital force because it explains that phenomenon. And so the reason that we came up with the idea of vitalism as a principal identifier of what we're doing in the Naturopathic Medicine Institute is because it identifies naturopathic medicine as vitalistic, because that's what it is. I would say it's almost, and this is going to be controversial, it's almost necessary to understand this principle in order to practice naturopathy. Because if you're not working with this principle, I would argue that you're not doing naturopathy. Naturopathy is not simply the use of naturally occurring stuff to do what allopathic doctors do, which is to suppress symptoms or to replace one morbid condition with another. That's allopathic medicine by definition. So, there's many examples of that. I guess one way to summarize that would be to say this, and I think I've already said this, but I'll say it again. The way you understand these two different ends or poles of the dichotomy that I mentioned, the ones to go back to Coulter here again, the way, if you understand that disease is affecting organs or systems, and that the symptoms are the disease, as opposed to the other end of the dichotomy where disease is a general fact which strikes the whole organism, it's either one or the other. And if you understand that the second attributes the origins of life and its functions to a superior vital energy, those are two different ways of understanding the world. And those are two different ways then, or understanding, I should say it this way, believing or accepting one or the other of those will determine your therapeutic rationale. Why do you do what you do? Why do you apply this therapy instead of that therapy? They're not all equal in their effect on the human physical organism, if there is in fact a superior vital formative intelligence, or if there's not. So that word not only describes what naturopathic doctors were and are from a historical and philosophical point of view, but it drives everything that you do in practice. That's a long-winded way to answer your simple question.
That was a really great answer. I mean, I'm sure you've seen kind of some of the comments that people in our profession are making in discussion groups on social media, where they tag vitalism as a cult of belief, or where somebody says, it wasn't even on the table at my school interview. It wasn't part of the classes I was taught. I was given no reason to believe that being an ND required being a vitalist, let alone what that definition entailed. I mean, I feel like this identity crisis that's happening, I think mostly amongst the younger docs who've come out of the schools, is because they're missing the central component of why we even exist.
So that actually brings up a question that someone asked along these lines, and that says that currently floating around that we define ourselves and I assume ourselves being vitalistic, as being opposed to the term allopathic. And how do you explain that to someone, that it's not necessarily in opposition? And how would you answer that? Because that is out there quite a bit. It has to be diametrically opposed.
The answer is no, and there's no opposition here at all. There might be some opposition on the political level, but I would refer you to the American Association, the American Medical Association, their House of Delegates, and their opposition to what we're doing. But that's a different story. Without talking about politics, let's talk about definitions. I don't have this right in front of me, but I have a dictionary of medical terms from 1865, which defines allopathy as the other. This is from the Greek, allopathic, the other pathos, the other suffering, the other disease. Allopathic is defined as, and this is not to be critical or to be downgrading or anything. It's a simple definition which describes the underlying philosophy. Allopathic medicine is a system of therapeutics where one morbid condition is removed by replacing it with another. Now, that sounds stupid. Maybe, if you look at it through the lens of vitalism or naturopathy, why would you replace one disease with another? Now, again, we're looking at the philosophical level here. So we're replacing one disease with another. The proof of that is the PDR. The list of what in conventional medicine are called side effects are what? Nothing more than a new disease, right? That is the consequence of a material or mechanistic understanding of the human body. A symptom crops up, be it a fever or low back pain or high blood pressure, and it is treated independent of and as if it's not connected to the rest of the system. It's treated at face value, one might say. Treating it makes the symptom, quote, go away. And by the way, whenever somebody says their symptoms went away, I'd like to ask this question, well, where do you think it went? Because that also goes to the foundation of what we're talking about. Where did it go? Well, the symptom went away, but the underlying perturbation, to quote Coulter here, is still there. And therefore, it has to be expressed in another way. And that new expression in our current medical system is called side effects. But in a philosophical way, that is to say, understanding the philosophy of medicine and the philosophy of healing, where the symptom went was it was transmuted into something else. That's what side effects are. By the way, side effects only occur in medicines that are used allopathically because they require the transformation of the symptom to a new set of symptoms. Call them side effects or whatever you will. That's in contrast to a different therapeutic rationale, which in this case is homeopathy, which is the same disease. And the difference there is you give the patient It's a system of therapeutics that's based on similars, where you give the patient that which would produce the same disease he already has. Now, that sounds a little weird too, unless you understand the underlying philosophy. Why in the world would you give a patient a substance or an intervention or have an intervention which would cause the symptoms that he or she already has? Well, that gets back to the philosophical understanding of the vital force. First of all, if there's a disturbance that affects the whole system, then the correction has to be at the whole system level. And since the vitalist holds that the symptoms are an expression of what the body is doing, i.e., the symptoms are the language, and I'm quoting Hippocrates here, the symptoms are the labor of the body in its attempts to restore normal. And if that's true, then you'd want to give that a little bit of a nudge. In other words, if the symptoms are producing show you how the body is producing a therapeutic attempt, then you want to attempt to stimulate that. And because of what I just said about hormesis, small doses of something will activate a reserve. I don't know what I did with my notes there. It'll activate that reserve effect.
Yeah.
So a medicine that's used homeopathically is based on a therapeutic intervention which will produce the same effect we already have in order to get that correction. This reminds me of something, again, my long-winded way of answering the question. There are no homeopathic remedies. I'll say that in English. There are no homeopathic remedies. There are potentized remedies that can be used homeopathically. Likewise, there are no allopathic medicines. There are medicines that can be used allopathically. What decides whether it's allopathic or homeopathic is not the person using it, nor the label on the bottle. Technically, philosophically speaking, whether something is allopathic or homeopathic is how it's used. In other words, is it allopathic to the case or is it homeopathic to the case? For example, belladonna can be used in a homeopathic way, but belladonna can also be used homeopathically. Tylenol can be used allopathically, but it can also be used if it's homeopathic to the case, and so on and so forth. So it's not, as all of the writers in our profession have pointed out over and over and over and over again, it's not what we do, it's why we do it. So we're not in contrast to or in conflict with allopathic medicine, certainly not in a country where there are about 3 million allopathic practitioners, including medical doctors, APRNs, and PAs, where there are how many of us? It's a competing dichotomy or a competing philosophical understanding of what disease is and therefore how a physician should approach it, if that could be called competition. As someone had pointed out to me just recently, maybe, and Coulter actually talks about this as well, in actual day-to-day therapeutic practice, there is a kind of eclectic mixture of different ways of intervening. But, as Coulter says, one is guided principally by one of these understandings or the other. So allopathic, again, is a descriptor. I think that we have to think about it that way. It's not, we're not using the word in a derogatory way. We're not using the word to say that we're competing with conventional medicine in that way. What we're saying is that's one way of doing it, and there's another way of doing it.
Mm-hmm. It's,
those of us, at least in my, amongst my contemporaries, are clear on the fact that we just would like to preserve the legacy that we inherited from these intelligent, critical thinkers from the past who have found what many of us think is a more effective way to practice medicine. Dr. Broadwell, one of my teachers, would have said that the naturopath uses these methods because they're superior in their outcome, not because they're necessarily natural, but because they're superior in their outcome.
Love it.
Love it. So, again, long-winded way to answer a question, huh?
Well, you know, I think one of the knocks that I hear on what we're doing at NMI is that somehow we're promoting a cult of belief, kind of a almost like a religious version of medicine rather than medicine. And one of the things that I think you've pointed out so clearly in today's conversation is that when you talk about the underlying philosophy behind a mechanistic form of medicine or a vitalistic form of medicine, in both cases, neither is provable except through our experience.
Exactly.
And their system, the dominant system, is as much a faith-based system as anyone could say about ours. It, as Gail Attell put it to me, it's the pot calling the kettle black.
Well, that's an interesting point. And then I know we're going to go on a little bit because we had agreed to do that. The one place where you could say religion creeps into this is that when you start talking about an unknowable, I mean, an unmeasurable, unquantifiable, and immaterial. I'm going to come back to that one in just a bit. There's something. Call it whatever you want. There's something that is informing the physical, material universe. So what is that something? Like Linmar said, the physical world is an expression of this. It's not creating this. You know, thus it appears that crude matter, instead of being the source of all life, is but an expression of the life force. Then you have to take the next step. Itself a manifestation of this creative intelligence, mm-hmm. which he goes on to say, some call God, some call nature, some call the oversoul, Brahma. If you believe that there's something there that informs the physical, then you might strive to give it some kind of name. If vital force isn't good enough, then you have to invoke something else. And that's where it starts to get quote unquote religion. Mm-hmm. But there's another thing, Rick, as you're just pointing out, Dr. Rick, you know, it's always been amazing to me the number of people who go to church on Sunday to, now I'm getting a little critical here, right? I noticed this when I was a kid, that how there are people who go to church on Sunday to sit and worship the omnipotence and greatness of their creator, and then they go to work on Monday, and that's not part of their reality. Mm-hmm. How does that work? And actually, you said something which might be useful also, I think, to all who are listening. When you get into both the organon of medicine and then Kent's lectures as he explains this, he makes it quite obvious. And if there's anybody that's listening here and you want to know more, you must read Linmar, Nature Cure, from cover to cover. You must read Hahnemann in the Organon of Medicine, and you absolutely must read Kent's lectures. These gentlemen, probably as well as anybody in the Western world, have explained all of what we're talking about here in great depth. In fact, you may, as I have from time to time, find yourself reading this and wondering, wow, am I supposed to know this? This is really, I mean, I better pull the shades, because this is almost heretical in our culture to speak about these ideas and how they inform us. But I want to say one thing about just sort of anecdotally. Kent speaks for Hahnemann in his interpretation of Hahnemann's organon about the immaterial. The immaterial being the non-material. Today we would say non-material. But in the translation from 100 and some years ago, he talks about the immaterial. Think about that for a second. Immaterial has taken on the meaning today that it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, meaning it's not matter.
Oh, wow.
There's no matter, right? What's the matter? right?
Yeah, wow.
When we say, what's the matter, we're asking, what has come into the physical, corporal, mechanical world that's manifesting for you? What's the matter? Right? As opposed to something being immaterial. Well, Pellegrino, who was a writer at Yale in medical philosophy and a medical doctor, said that what a doctor thinks disease is will determine what he or she does. Mm-hmm. And it's just really that simple.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like that line from, again, back to Alice in Wonderland. It's like that line where she is talking to the cat, to the Cheshire Puss. Would you tell me, please, which way I ought to go from here? That depends a great deal on where you want to get to, says the cat. I don't much care where, said Alice. Well, then it doesn't much matter which way you go. So long as I get somewhere, says Alice. Oh, well, you're sure to do that, said the cat. If only you walk long enough. So how do you know where you're trying to, if you don't know where you want to end up, how do you know how to proceed? And that brings us back to these two ideas.
Fantastic. You know, Petersburg did some work on developing a declaration for us at NMI, and I've been editing it with the help of you and a few of the other senior vitalists, and it seems like a good time just to declare this, that vitalistic naturopathy holds that the laws of nature are immutable, infallible, and cannot be circumvented nor improved upon. That life is more than biochemical and physiological reactions. It is vital, changing, growing, developing, and this is what animates life. That there is design and function in the human organism without which no treatment could ever bring real healing and a restoration of health. That every acute disease is the result of a purifying healing effort of nature. That the suppression of acute disease can lead to more chronic disease. That the symptoms experienced during illness result from a beneficial effort to restore balance and are to be welcomed rather than feared and should not be suppressed except in extreme cases. And that the function of a vitalist physician is to utilize treatments that remove obstacles to healing and stimulate, support, assist, and enhance the natural healing process. And all of this emerges from this paradigm, which we're calling vitalism.
I think that's
exactly
a great definition. And somebody else just, you know, had sent me a question. And so I'm going to tweak this a little bit. And it has to do with the profession as a whole creating a cohesive branding. And I think what you've touched on today, and this is kind of shifting my thought process around this, is decide the conversation, if you're talking to our colleagues, is the conversation that you're attempting to have about a political perspective or perspective on how you practice. Because if you merge and blend the two, it becomes very confusing. But if you separate them, it becomes significantly easier to deal with. So if you have a political perspective of naturopathy is a doctor who deals with nature, it does not say how you must deal with nature. And from there, you then move into the practice aspect of how you choose to practice. That's kind of a way that I'm seeing this shift and be shaped based on the definition that Dr. Kirshner read, based on what you have read to us from Coulter, talking about Lindlar, et cetera, that we really are looking at, is it a political that you want to be branded so that, for example, New Mexico is now appears to be licensed or will be soon? That's the political side. How you choose to practice, the profession should embrace all of it. And that's where, if you separate the conversations, maybe they'll be a little easier. And maybe that will help you move forward and be able to look at, when they use the term allopathic, it's a definition of tool sets and how they're used, not who the practitioner is. Because we, as vitalists, could also practice and use the allopathic tool set if it was appropriate. And you blend them.
Well, that's a good point to make. There's a time, even as Coulter points out, there's a time in almost every practice where one may be practicing the other, based on another philosophical understanding. Because after all, what we really want is what's best for the patient. And so there's this eclectic mix sometimes. But you, again, as he says, that the practitioner of these different schools is either understanding one of these ends of the dichotomy or the other, because that drives what he's trying or she's trying to do. And it defines the potential outcome there. But there's nothing, back to the question that was raised earlier, this is not to be derogatory about allopathic medicine. There is a time and a place where the suppression of symptoms is absolutely necessary, if not life-saving. Mm-hmm. And all of you can think of examples of that. The question is, what are you trying to accomplish and what? If it's saving lives when somebody's, having some kind of a severe anaphylactic reaction, then I think you want to talk to your allopath, right? Or you want allopathic treatment. If you're trying to restore health with somebody who has got a chronic illness, then that requires different tools, just as one needs different tools for a different job, right? So, well, we're way over time today, aren't we?
Well, I'm loving this, and I'd be willing to bet everybody that listens to this is going to be so grateful for this chance to just hear from you, Jim, about why the Naturopathic Medicine Institute is identifying this paradigm and how that is of importance to our entire profession. So I'm really grateful for this chance to hear about this from you today.
And thanks for coming on with me today, and Dr. Kinley, for your comments as well. Are we at a point where we should wind this up, or is there more on your end?
I have nothing else on my end. Dr. Kirshner, do you have any other thoughts? I mean, it's pretty hard to beat the statement read to us, but
I think we've got it done, and my guitar is calling to me, and I think I have an answer.
Okay, great. All right, thank you. Thank you, everybody, for joining us on the call today, and we'll talk to you next week, same time.
Thank you.